So I'd just like to, now just take a moment to appreciate that Luangpor Pasno is with us this weekend. Luangpor is a senior monk in the Ajahn Chah lineage. He ordained in quite a few years ago, 1974, I believe.
That's correct, yeah.
That was a good year for Canadian monks, right?
Oh, yeah, we got a whole gaggle of them. That's when Viradamo, Ajahn Tiradamo.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, we're all the same vintage.
Yes. Come on in. Luangpor Pasno ordained in Thailand, and what I think is so valuable and beautiful, he spent time with Ajahn Chah and at Wat Patpong in Thailand, and was the abbot of the International Forest Monastery, or Wat Pananachat, I believe for 12 years.
15.
Yeah.
Hmm? 15.
15 years. And not to be deterred, then he moved on to be the abbot of Abayagiri, because he was having so much fun being abbot. And quite a few years, 20...
What's that? It must be 21, 22.
21 or 22 years at Abayagiri. Like so we can just think about this positive influence and impact that Luangpor has had, training many, many monks and lay people over these years. About a year ago or so, Luangpor stepped down from being the abbot at Abayagiri and has spent the last year on retreat, half the time in Thailand, and then more recently spending the winter and spring at with the Ajahn Sona at Birken Forest Monastery. So it's very, very nice that that you could be on retreat and spend a winter in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
Ajahn originally is from northern Manitoba, so I don't know, shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, I didn't even get to pull my long johns out.
Yeah.
He was only got to minus 30.
It was a super insulated hootie in a cabin, deluxe at Birken. And most recently has been kayaking off the coast of Cortez Island in the last few days, and survived that, and has made his way down to spend some time with us. So welcome, Ajahn.
Okay.
So I suggest for those if you would like to participate, we'll just bow three times, and you don't have to get off your chair if you want, but just to pay respects to Ajahn. And then June will do a chant, which is kind of a formal chant of requesting teachings.
Namo Tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so welcome everybody. Good morning to you all. We have the opportunity over these next couple days, today, tomorrow, for those who will plug in for the whole bit, and you know, whatever the case, however much one can plug into, we'll explore teachings and practice. The Brock came up with a title that I can basically say anything I want. It's just what is it? Reflections on the Path of Practice or something. Yeah, there we go. So, I think, you know, just as we have begun by June making a formal request for teachings and then the short chant that I did was just paying homage to the Buddha and the Triple Gem as a basis of how we receive teachings and how teachings are hopefully given, in that it's not really a personal thing. You know, it's not about a person. It's about the aspects of refuge and Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and seeing that we're, you know, especially as a path of practice, we're taking it into a larger context, because so often, especially in the West, whatever it is, and not even talking about Buddhism, it tends to be all about me, you know, in terms of it's me, my path, my practice, my life, my difficulties, my joys, my sorrows, and that whole burden of me is one of the things that we have the opportunity to just to put down kind of lightly and not have to carry it. And that's that opportunity of recognizing that we, from a Buddhist perspective, we have these refuges that we can be lifting our hearts up to, and the refuge of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, not so much as a historical Buddha or a statue of the Buddha, but the qualities of the Buddha. And so the qualities of and say literally translated, the word Buddha means awake, or one who is awakened. And that's there's a discourse in the scriptures where the Buddha has he's gone off for the day to spend some quiet time in the forest, and a learned Brahmin priest sees these footprints of somebody going off, and he says, recognize this is somebody who has some special characteristics. And this is, I say, part of the Brahminic lore is also knowing the marks of a great being, both in terms of, say, like if one is learned in palmistry or something like that. And so it's also just the footprint. This is somebody who especially comes up, follows those tracks, and then sees this figure sitting under a tree who looks really, you inspiring, peaceful, noble, special somehow. And he comes up and he pays respects and he asks, what are you? Who are you? What are you? And, are you some sort of special heavenly being? Are you some kind of, are you some kind of special, powerful sort of yaka or some sort? And, no, are you a human? No. Well, what are you? And the Buddha said, just know me as one who is awake. And that's when the Buddha defining himself. So that's the opportunity that we have. And we have the opportunity to have that quality of awakening and being awake. In the Thai language, when they, like in our normal chanting, when they translate the word Buddha, it's translated as the one who knows, the one who is awakened, the radiant one. So it's these qualities of knowing, and of course that's your foundation in mindfulness, awareness, attention, and then the sense of awakening, being alert and present, but then also radiant. And the radiance, as the word that's used is like the same word that's used like with a flower that opens, so that they, there's a kind of a beauty and even an intensity of color with a flower that's newly opened. And that's the same sort of word when you think of this kind of radiance and happiness, brightness of being. So that's something that we can incline our hearts towards as well. This is something that is not belonged to, and doesn't belong to anybody. These are qualities in nature that we have the opportunity to access. And especially when we think of terms of, say, reflections on a path of practice, one of the things that particularly, I spent this last year in retreat, and oftentimes think of people will ask, what meditation did you do? How many hours did you meditate? How many, and all of the actual technique or method or activity that one was involved in. And if I wanted to encapsulate what, say, a year of retreat meant to me, was this a year of continuing to deepen my connection with refuge. And that's something that again, your one is able to shed that whole me and my agenda and enter more deeply into refuge. And of course, that's where this freedom and liberation of and peace of the Buddha's path is truly accessible. And that the refuge of Dhamma is just the refuge of truth. It doesn't belong to anybody. It isn't anywhere. It isn't written in any particular book. It's there. And so that being able to open the heart to the true nature of things. And sometimes it's delightful and uplifting and inspiring, and other times it sort of hits you it's like last night we had a gathering at Brock and June's. A few people came over for tea, and then for opportunity for questions and answers. And then one of the first questions was from a woman who had just lost her son, and many of you might have heard of the accident that a young boy was killed with a tree crushing him. Well, the mother came last night, and everybody else's questions kind of disappeared after that. You know, it was sort of like that. Me and my problems don't seem very very compelling compared to the suffering of a mother who's just lost her son. So it's it's a truth. That is our one of the ways that Ajahn Chah used to, again, in the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha points to, say, universal characteristics, fundamental truths, truth of impermanence, truth of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, truth of not self, and oftentimes when you think of it in terms of impermanence, it's easy to objectify. But Ajahn Chah, more often than not, when he would translate, or what the word that he would use, the phrase that he would use to express that, say, anicca, that the truth of impermanence, would be uncertainty or unsure. And that, because that's actually, that's a subjective feeling. That's how we feel when things change. And it's really important to pay attention to that, because as long as we keep objectifying, then we can distance ourselves from it. It's not really happening to me. I'm not really getting old. I'm not really, because it's sort of out there somewhere. I'll maybe deal with it sometime. or sickness is just something that it happens to people in hospitals, but not me. Mm-hmm. It's not articulated that clearly, but emotionally, oftentimes that's how it's felt. We keep a certain separation from the truths and realities of human existence, and then when it comes up and slaps us in the face, and we just, how can this be? This is really shocking. What a surprise. But when we contemplate, say, the true nature of things, then, we get the whole package. But then the more we're able and willing to really look at, embrace, and deeply contemplate that whole package, that's where this quality of stability and clarity and radiance can actually emerge. So that sense of the refuge is deepening our refuge and being willing to allow that refuge to settle in the heart. And the same, the refuge in Sangha is a refuge in, it's a refuge in virtue, integrity. Those are when the Buddha, in the traditional chants as we recollect Sangha as refuge, it literally means community, but what it's pointing to, when the Buddha describes it, it's pointing to those who, say, who practice well or practice in a good way. So it's about practice, and there's this reflections on a path of practice as a theme today. Just reflecting that sense of practicing in a good way, practicing directly, so that it's not taking the long way around and wandering too far off the path. This is what needs to be done. I got to keep on task. I got to keep on there. and you know, practicing with a sense of knowledge and understanding, commitment to knowing clearly, and then the last is a practicing. Literally, it's sort of like appropriately, properly, but it's more like practicing with integrity. So so these are the qualities that we, again, embody, and it isn't about, you know, those people who do that or able to do that. It's about us taking on that sense of integrity and commitment to practice and training ourselves in that way. And it's because it's important to recognize that the Buddha's teaching there's an integration that is there, both in terms of understanding, knowledge, vision of what are the true nature of things, but then also living and practicing in a way that accords with that, and that those two have to go together. Without that, then it's out of balance. In the sense, you know, one can, and that's one of the words that is used to describe the Buddha, is say like in our chanting at Abhayagiri or in our communities, in the scriptural language of Vijajarna Sampanno, but then the translation is impeccable in conduct and understanding, and those two go together, so that having that knowledge, understanding, but then our actions of body and speech accord with that. And because sometimes we can get overly either focused, stressed, obsessed with getting the right action. Like sometimes the precepts are held that way, and you can end up getting very, or the meditation technique, or the aspects of practice, and that gets held, but then there's not the kind of insight and knowledge that helps one to transcend that. So one is usually ends up stressed out and trying to be a good Buddhist, you know, trying to be a good practitioner. And, we can torture ourselves with that and not be very happy about it, which is not so useful. And then similarly, the balance of knowledge and like you can have, you know, great knowledge and insight, or, you know, like an analytical understanding through intellect, and because really the truths of the Buddha are not that, they're not abstruse, they're not that difficult to figure out, but it's like, how do we live in accordance with that? And so that sense of, so sometimes you even just because one has like an intellectual grasp of something, doesn't mean that it's actually changed the heart and hasn't transformed one. So there's this, that's what the path of practice is, a giving ourselves to that kind of training, contemplation, and investigation, so that it transforms the heart and things start to come into balance. I remember one time when I was still a very young monk, and my brother came to visit me in Thailand. And, in those days, the conditions were very basic in the monastery. It's a fairly new monastery, recently established, and it's in the poorest part of Thailand. And yeah, it was just very, very simple, very basic. And my brother comes and spends a bit of time, and finally he asked me, you know, what do you see, or what do you, you know, why are you doing this sort of, why are you living like this? And, you know, what have you seen? Or what is the some sort of special understanding or knowledge that is, kind of motivates you to live like this? And then I said, well, it's just really, this sense of impermanence and uncertainty and change. And because to me it was very fresh at the time, and it was really, exploring that. And he looks at me as if I'm just incredibly stupid. And he said, everybody knows that. Which is really true. Everybody knows. But we often don't adjust our understanding or our lives or our way of being in order to align ourselves with it. So it's like this is ongoing exploration, because it's not, even though these are simple truths, they're not that easy to really to penetrate and to allow that change to take place within ourselves and to give ourselves to actually be, it's like to actually being peaceful. For all of the, for anybody who's come here today, everybody has an appreciation of peace and wanting to be peaceful in some way. And then what actually happens when, either you're in a physical setting or you have been meditating and the mind starts to become a little bit peaceful, what happens? Just the mind conjures up something else to do, something else to think about, something to proliferate about, something to grumble about. And it's just what the mind does. It's just looking for something else other than being peaceful, being content, being kind of aware and spacious. They're nice sort of concepts, but then the mind tries to avoid it when it has the opportunity. So it's like being willing to steep oneself in that those, as the mind starts to settle, as the mind starts to experience a certain awareness, to not buying into the proliferations that the mind cranks out. There's a discourse that the Buddha actually it doesn't give so much as it's a conversation between him and one of his disciples, Aniruddha. And Aniruddha is actually his cousin as well. And Aniruddha has been off in the forest and meditating, and he has this insight of all the things that constitute the qualities of a great being, a great person. Things like contentment and I can't remember them all right now, but contentment and mindfulness and compassion and wisdom and effort and all of these and these seven kind of really virtuous qualities. And he's kind of stoked on this insight, and he goes back to the Buddha relates his experience during the day, and so he felt that these are the qualities of a great being. And the Buddha says, "Yes, yes, it's so, Anuruddha." He says, "But add one more quality." And he says, "Oh, what's that?" He said, "Delight in non-complication." which is really quite beautiful, that sense of that non-complication, non-proliferation. Because even when you feel peaceful, or there's the heart is really kind of spacious with loving kindness, and then, we'll proliferate about it. we'll come up with a storyline. It's what human beings do. We're great at stories, of course. And the most compelling story, again, is the story of me. So just being able to give some space around that, letting it fall away. And that falling away isn't falling away is the non-complication. And the falling away is the opening to real kind of peace and stability of heart. So that these refuges of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, it's one of the, if you think about it, it's really, it's one of the fundamentals of the Buddhist path, or kind of Buddhism 101. But it's also something that one continues to deepen and enter into more fully as one continues to practice. It's like in Thailand, there's he's passed away some time ago, and people who've been reading about Buddhism in Thailand will probably heard of Ajahn Mun. He's kind of like the grandfather of the forest tradition. He inspired a huge number of practitioners and teachers who have kept the tradition going. Of course, he was one of my own teachers, Ajahn Chah's teacher and inspiration. And in the account of Ajahn Mun's own awakening, enlightenment experience, realization, and he was somebody who was known for his dedication, commitment, vigor in practice. And and in those days, it was something like the practice had kind of really waned, had really fallen off. There weren't any clear examples. So that he reinvigorated a whole couple generations now of practice and actual confidence that there is the fruits of this practice. And I think that's the story of say Buddhist history. It comes and goes and degenerates and re-arises again, because the teachings are there. And so it's just following the teachings and having that confidence. But then the immediate response that Ajahn Mun felt and had on his kind of enlightenment experience was just to immediately bow to the Buddha. I mean, there wasn't any Buddha image around. There wasn't any. He was in the forest, but it's just that act of appreciation, respect, gratitude to the Buddha having given this path. And he's somebody, when you read about, there's very little of his own writings. and is of his own teachings. It's most of its accounts, and then his actual biography was. And he comes across as incredibly austere and formidable, which he probably was as well. But then also that, you know, these aspects of devotion and gratitude are there, and that's the first thing that came out. And so that sense of refuge. So that whenever we think in terms of practice, meditation practice, mindfulness training, these are. I think it's really helpful to what context are we practicing in? What's the bigger picture? Because it can be obscured or lost even sometimes, because also one of the ways of characterizing the Buddha's teaching and the Buddha's path is that it is a path of training or a path of, and the word is like when say in the Buddha's first teaching on the where he laid out the Four Noble Truths of dukkha, of suffering, unsatisfactoriness, its cause, its cessation, and the path leading to cessation of suffering or of dissatisfaction. That path is, you know, say, Eightfold Path, but then the Eightfold Path is oftentimes kind of distilled into what's called the three trainings in virtue, meditation, wisdom. And that word, those trainings are, the word is sikha, and literally it means more like learning. So, and of course in the Buddha's time, the way you learn something was not by reading about it, it was by doing, or hearing, listening. In those days, it wasn't like the early scriptures for the first 300-400 years after the Buddha passed away, they were oral teachings, and it wasn't that in Indian culture at that time didn't know about writing. They had a refined system of writing. But it was considered something that was good for kind of bureaucrats and the court to, for accountants and, yeah, basically accountants and bureaucrats, and that's how you kept a record of all those things. But spiritual teachings, you wanted to keep them fresh by having an oral tradition that you listened to and you heard them, you took them in, you committed them to memory, and you put them into practice. And you didn't write them down because that was a way of how do you say, like circumventing the process of learning. So that's for the conception. So the learning, you listening, hearing, but then putting it into practice. So that's what sikha. So it's like the path of the Buddhas is one that's it's based on training, education, as opposed to say like Abrahamic religions, which tend to be paths of faith or belief. So it's not a belief system, it's an education system. And learning to educate ourselves, train ourselves in the things that matter, which is body, speech, and mind, our actions of that we engage in the world, the the faculty of speech and the aspects of mind, of heart, of emotion, which is another thing in the sense that the word for mind in say in Buddhism encompasses both the say rational, intellectual, emotional range of our internal expression. So that and that needs to be trained. We need to educate ourselves in how to use our hearts and minds in a way that doesn't create dissonance and discontent, confusion, and agitation, so that they say the mindfulness practices, meditation practices are say a direct tool to facilitate that, to help that, but it's in conjunction with the training of precepts, of having certain standards that one lives by, and conducts oneself, not as a commandment, but as a training. So I remember Ajahn Chah would always say that whether we were as monastics and we have a lot more rules than the lay people, or the lay community, the purpose of the precepts is to have a tool to reflect back of what our intention or our motivation is. So what we see, there's a certain standard or a certain precept that's there, not harming, not killing, not stealing, and being honest in speech and not using harsh speech and things. And it's not so much to sort of whip you into shape and get you doing all the right things, but it's to provide a mere saying that there's a fundamental a certain problem that is being when we commit to something like that, there's almost certainly going to be an unwholesome or unskillful result. But in order to really understand it, we have to understand our own motivation, our own intention, that volition within the mind, within the heart. What's pushing us that way? What's it going towards? Because usually, what's happening? Anything that we do, especially if we're following an impulse of greed, or we're following an impulse of anger, we tend to follow it because in that moment, with a lack of clarity, we're trying to reduce our dukkha. We're trying to reduce our suffering. That's what it feels like at the time. If I just blasted that person, everything would be okay for now. If I just got that, and then it'd be okay. It's just using that as that impulse to reflect on. Say, is that really true? Is that really so? Is that the way it is? And then what would happen if I didn't follow it? And you start, it gives you a bigger context. So that training of our actions and speech and mind, they're all a one piece. When we think of a path of practice, it's a training that encompasses all of our being. And then certainly in terms of the mind and learning how to train the mind in order to settle enough that we start to get understanding of those impulses of mind, habits of mind, conditioning of mind that keep the heart unsettled. Today we'll have a day to explore the meditation and training and practice and you know, I think to keep that in mind in terms of why we're doing it. It's not just to say fulfill a particular technique and get that technique and get the right walk or the right posture of sitting. I mean, good posture and doing things in a circumspect way is good, but it's also to turn that attention back onto to the heart and really get a feel for where's it going, what's it doing, what's pulling it, and can I release that? And if I did release that, what would I experience? What would I feel? You know, sometimes it's inspiring, sometimes, oh, I don't know if I want to go there. You know? But again, that's where the function of refuge is both something to aspire towards, but also something to sustain one as one continues to practice, to train, to explore this path, and. So we'll be exploring the meditation and as we go through our day, I would give a talk and then we do some walking meditation, come back and do some sitting meditation, there'll be a lunch break. When we begin the afternoon session, I'll begin it with a Q&A session. One is to give people an opportunity to ask questions, the other is to not bore people into falling asleep by giving a talk or starting with meditation. So there will be opportunities for people to, if you've got questions that come up, we'll begin the afternoon with a Q&A session. And we'll begin with walking meditation. I'll just give a bit of instruction on walking meditation. Then when we come back for the sitting, I'll give a bit of instruction on sitting meditation. And we can... take it bit by bit. For the walking meditation, traditionally the Buddha speaks of the four postures of meditation: walking, sitting, standing, lying down. So it's you've got the opportunity to meditate whenever. It's not something absolutely special or locked into, but walking and sitting are the most common as one's developing a meditation practice. But it is important to recognize that meditation is something that one carries with one. So then having a familiarity with, walking and applying mindfulness. And in doing that, it's just taking and here we've got a lot of space. The venue is great because we've got a lot of space. There's flat spaces all around. There's walkways. There's shady, grassy areas, so people can go and find a suitable spot and take a flat spot. Mark it in your mind for yourself of about 15, 20 paces, 25 at most, whatever feels comfortable. And then begin by clasping the hands in front. It's sort of like you're composing the body. So you're not sort of marching along and composing physically, keeping the eyes kind of downcast. I mean, you don't want to close your eyes and run into people, but keeping the eyes downcast. You're not. It's not a nature walk. I mean, it's a it's a prescribed exercise for a cultivating a continuity of attention and awareness. So you're using the walking posture as a vehicle for developing that continuity of attention, so that bringing attention down into the sensation of touch, in terms of, of course, the most prominent would be the touch of the feet touching the ground or feet touching the walkway, and to walk a little bit slower than normal. You don't have to walk super slow, but just slowing down a little bit, because that slowing down, if we slow down physically, again, it helps us to slow down mentally or emotionally. Right? That slowing things down so we can start to experience and observe the what's coming up. And just, of course, the mind's going to wander. Fingers are going to just keep coming. You don't have to create another story about that. Sort of, okay, let it go. Come back to the sensation of touch. And that's keeping that simplicity of just paying attention to the lifting, raising, setting down of one foot, lifting, raising, setting down of the other foot, slowly walking, you know, comfortable, what feels comfortable, figure it out for yourself. And you get to the end of the path that you've designated, just turn around, but it's helpful to stop just for a bit and say, okay, am I present? Am I here? Because oftentimes you'll find you're not. And you can, because it's easy to back and forth, back and forth, and realize you just spent 20 minutes proliferating about whatever, you know, what's going to happen next week or what happened last week. So that just, you get to the end of the path and just, again, that conscious, composing, settling back into awareness. And if you are present, great, you can delight in that. And beginning again, so that beginning again, and then walking slowly, the end of the path that you set, just back and forth, and it'd be, you know, something like, and 20 minutes, half an hour, or something like that, and so that just being ready to reestablish that quality of mindfulness, reestablish that quality of attention. And because it's that continuity of awareness and attention that allows the heart to settle. And that's where it isn't trying to force the mind to be peaceful, force the mind not to be thinking. Because sometimes we think, you know, there's a very simple equation that we tend to come up with. You know, I think, therefore I suffer. So then it's a logical conclusion. Well, if I wasn't thinking, then I wouldn't suffer. And that's not how it works. You know, it's like just recognizing whatever thinking's going on, and you know, whether it's, you know, what one classifies as a good thought or a bad thought or whatever, it's just a thought. And come back to awareness and attention, and that it's that continuity of attention and awareness and a willingness to let go of whatever, and again, letting go isn't annihilating and destroying. It's just sort of not hanging on to, not proliferating, not reacting to the thoughts too much. It's just sort of, okay, it's just there. But what is here is the sensation of touch, sensation of movement, this present moment that I can be in, I can return to. And just to explore that and see what happens. So if we take about, come back about, say, 25 after, it's about 5-2, disperse in different directions for walking meditation, and then come back. Okay? And we'll have a sitting then.